There's a new book about the history of kid food. The author is Kim Zachman. And Kim, there are a lot of local connections to the genesis of some of our favorite foods, aren't there?
There are. There's a large population of German immigrants that settled in the Chicago and Milwaukee areas. So, yeah, we've got some good stories from Chicago.
The book is there's no ham and hamburgers, and here in the Midwest, well, Wisconsin figures into the history of the hamburger, doesn't it?
It does, yes, because there's a kind of a controversy about who was the first person to put the ground beef patty on a bun. But one of my favorites, he's my favorite of the ones who claim it, is Charlie Negrin from Seymour, Wisconsin. One reason he was my favorite, because he was only 15 years old, and he was selling food at the Outagamie County Fair. And he ran out of sausages and stuff, so he just kind of put his patty on a bun real quick and started selling it. And he called it the hamburger because it was a hamburg steak, basically, a hamburg steak, and he put it on a bun. But he's kind of my favorite because he was only 15 when he started that, and that was in 1885. Seymour, Wisconsin has a big festival every year because they claim to be the home of the hamburger.
Well, they should have a big fest there. And McDonald's, of course, known as much for the development of the chicken McNugget as they are the hamburger. And who is the guy that came up with that here? He was a member of the executive team over there, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was Fred Turner, but Ray Kroc had something to do with it because Ray Kroc had hired this French-trained chef named René Arend, who was actually from Belgium, but he had been trained in France. So he's a classically trained chef, and Ray Kroc finally talked him into coming over to their kitchen and start coming up with new recipes. And at the time, that was in like 1977, McDonald's was freaking out a little bit because the U.S. government had just come out and said, hey, you know, beef is bad. Beef causes heart attacks, all that. You need to eat more fish, more chicken. And McDonald's was like, oh, we got to get something on the menu quick, you know, because people are going to not eat as many hamburgers. So Ray Kroc got René Arend to come up with some chicken dishes. He tried a chicken pot pie, and that didn't go over so well. And it's Fred Turner, the chairman, said something to him, why don't you try like a chicken nugget? And he did. Renee came up with one, and Fred's like, that's it. That's it. That's what we're going to do. And he did a SWAT team. He formed a SWAT team because actually making the chicken nugget, mass producing it, was very difficult at the time. It was a lot of man hours to debone the chicken. And then there was a kind of a complicated process of getting the batter to stay on between the freezing and the frying process. But it took them about a year. But they did come up with it. And they tested it in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1980, and it went bonkers. Hmm. Within 2 years, they were second only to Kentucky Fried Chicken in the amount of chicken they sold.
But as you point out in the book, though, remember, the chicken does not have any fingers. Just keep that in mind.
That's right.
And I like the nutrition information you have as well. You write about potatoes being good for you, but not necessarily those French fries. But if you can avoid the frying, potatoes, you say there's more potassium in there than even bananas, right?
Yes, potatoes are. I mean, potatoes really are a very nutritious food, and they kept a large part of the world's population alive for a long time. They get a little bit of a bad vibe these days because of the high carb index in them. They are fairly high in carbohydrates, so some people say white potatoes aren't good for you for that reason, but they really are nutritious food if they're not fried. Of course, we know frying's not good for anybody.
Yeah, they're high in...
makes it taste a lot better, though.
Yes, it does. But you can get vitamin C and B. And we always argue about pizza around here, but I don't think there's any doubt that the pan pizza was created in Chicago at Pizzeria Uno.
Yeah, that's what my research... And the reason why I thought was really funny, the owners, Ike Sewell and Rick Ricardo, they wanted something different. Anyway, they wanted something different than what was going on other styles of pizza around them. But they also thought, so we make it really thick and it cooks longer, and the customers have to sit there and wait on their pizza because it cooks longer, they'll order more drinks. So I thought, that's a pretty good theory. That's a good way to get your tab up a little bit higher there.
Yeah, makes sense. At one time, Chicago was the chocolate capital of the world. We think about Hershey, Pennsylvania a lot, but Milton Hershey actually got started around here, didn't he?
Yeah, Milton Hershey had already made millions with his candy company. He made caramels, and he had already made a lot of money, and he was sort of, in a way, semi-retired. And he was traveling around, and he went to the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, and he saw this amazing exhibit that was completely made out of chocolate. It was a 38-foot-tall statue, and it looked like a gazebo with a statue in it. It was completely made of chocolate. And the whole how to make chocolate factory was part of the exhibit. And that was it. He said, that's it. I'm going to make chocolate. He bought that whole exhibit and shipped it back to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And that's where he started making his chocolate. But he just got captivated by this when he was at the Chicago Fair.
Yeah, who wouldn't? For years, I've heard people arguing about the Baby Ruth candy bar. Was it named after Babe Ruth? Was it named after somebody else? But the beginning of the Baby Ruth bar was Chicago, wasn't it?
It was, yes. The Curtis Candy Company. And the owner was Otto Schnering. And in 1920, he came up with this really great candy bar. And he called it the Baby Ruth. Well, just happened to be when Babe Ruth was probably the biggest celebrity in America at the time. And Schnering had a great idea of how to promote his new candy bar. He had hired airplanes, and they put tiny little parachutes on tiny little candy bars, and he dropped it over the city. Well, it worked great. I mean, Baby Ruth became just a hit right away. Well, Babe Ruth was not happy about this at all. I mean, his name's getting used without his permission. So he sues Schnering. Well, they go to court. Schnering claims that he had named the candy bar after Ruth Cleveland, the daughter of Grover Cleveland. Well, that was weird for lots of reasons. One, Grover Cleveland hadn't been president for over 20 years. Two, Ruth Cleveland had died of diphtheria in 1903, 17 years before the candy bar came out. So he was claiming that he had named the candy bar after a past president's dead daughter. Well, nobody believed him. Nobody. I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. But they couldn't prove that he didn't name it after Ruth Cleveland, and he won. He won the case, and he got to keep the name.
Yeah, well, some lawyer came up with a good idea, I think.
And I just think that's hilarious.
I'm really interested in your stories about cereal and sugar, and actually, in the beginning, there wasn't a lot of sugar in the cereal, but then there was, and it led to kind of a family feud. Tell us about this.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, those Kellogg brothers. Well, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and his brother, Will Keith Kellogg, ran the Battle Creek, Michigan Sanitarium. Now, they were Seventh-day Adventists, so they didn't believe, you know, no caffeine, no alcohol, no tobacco, and really no sugar, too. And they really believed in plant-based diets. So they were trying to come up with a ready-to-eat cereal, because when Dr. John Harvey was in college, he lived in a little boarding room, and he couldn't cook his oatmeal. He didn't have any place to cook. And he just thought it would be great if we had cereal you could just eat right out of the box. So they worked on it for a couple of years, and they finally developed a wheat flake, and it was selling pretty good. But Dr. John was so busy with patients that Will Keith kind of kept experimenting on his own, and he found out that corn worked better. He also discovered that if you put some sugar in it, it had better shelf life, more stable, and it tasted better. Well, Dr. John found out that he put sugar in the recipe, and they had a big argument, big fight, and they split up, and Will Keith went across town and opened up his own company selling cornflakes. And of course, he made lots and lots and lots of money doing that. So, yeah, it was a big, big fight.
He didn't go to Post or some company we know about, did he?
No, Post stole the idea.
Oh.
Post actually, C.W. Post actually was a patient at the sanitarium and knew the Kellogg brothers.
Oh, I see.
He actually helped in their experimental kitchen some. And so he completely stole everything and went across town and opened up Post and started selling Post Toasties.
I love these
the same
stories.
Time that, yeah, I know. There's just a lot of pirating going on in the cereal world.
The book is There's No Ham in Hamburgers by Kim Zachman, Facts and Folklore About Our Favorite Foods. I'll be thinking about the book at lunchtime today, Kim. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a
appreciate
great
it.
One.